Right, as a professional, but not a professional philosopher by any means, Socrates is one of my great heroes, along with Rick from Casablanca. And my aim is to show how he embodies, both for the ancient Greeks and for us, the point, or at least one point, of philosophy. After a short introduction about the evidence for Socrates' views and the philosophical climate in which he lived, I'm going to use Plato's dialogue Euthyphro as an example of Socrates' general practice. Then I'll pick out certain features of it as central to the man, show how they're described by Socrates himself in Plato's version of his defense speech, the Apology. And then after discussing how Socrates' technical arguments are relevant to ordinary life, I'll argue that his philosophy was meant for the people of Athens in general, and conclude with the claim that Socrates can and should inspire us today. First, a warning. The Socrates I'm talking about is, like Rick, a fictional character. That's not to say he didn't exist. We know he was born in about 469 BC. He lived in Athens, and he was executed after a trial in 399. But he wrote nothing, as far as we know. It's not that, like so many Greek authors, his works have been lost over time. He simply didn't write any. But shortly after his death, various members of his fan club began to write fictional dialogues in which Socrates was the leading character. These became a literary genre known as Socratic dialogues. Only those of Plato and Xenophon survive, and we can take it that each writer used that literary form to push his own attitudes and theories. The Socrates I'm talking about is the character who takes the lead in what are thought to be the earlier dialogues written by Plato, that is, the dialogues in which Socrates questions other people about their views, rather than those dialogues like the Republic, in which he expounds views of his own, which are fairly obviously Plato's own theories. These works include the Apology, which is the Greek for defense speech rather than apology, and Plato wrote this as if it was delivered by Socrates at his trial. And what Socrates says about himself is entirely consistent with his character as described in those early dialogues. Now, before I get on to Socrates himself, I'll keep you in suspense for another minute or two by filling you in with the state of things philosophically when Socrates hit the scene in Athens in the middle of the 5th century BC. Now, a very crude account of traditional Greek beliefs might go something like this. The gods are responsible for just about everything, both the physical world and the moral and legal codes by which we're expected to live. Morality in particular was based on the concept of virtue, it's the Greek word arete, which means something not so much like our word virtue, but more excellence, including a large element of worldly success, as well as moral scruples. There were usually five specific virtues mentioned in any discussion: justice, piety, courage, self-control, and wisdom. But since about 600 BC, various philosophers have been proposing theories about the physical state of the world, which did not assume a divine role. So in that area, the gods were being marginalized, at least in intellectual circles. Then during the 5th century BC, some philosophers, like Protagoras, floated skeptical ideas in the areas of morals and politics too. It was suggested that the moral laws have actually been invented by men rather than gods. Around the time of Socrates' adulthood, there were several such intellectuals known as sophists who came from various Greek cities but often visited Athens, and who taught young men, those who were prepared to pay, various academic subjects, including particularly public speaking and philosophy. There was a general perception that these sophists held rather radical views, sceptical of traditional ideas of the gods and morality. And that made them suspect in the eyes of traditionalists, especially the fathers of sons who were taught by them. For example, we read in the first part of Plato's Republic, for the whole, so that's the bit before it gets onto what Plato thinks, that the whole structure of moral rules was regarded by some as designed by the ruling class to serve the interests of the ruling class. And by others, morality was regarded as a contract between us whereby we forego our natural desire to injure each other in exchange for the right not to be injured by each other. In neither case is morality regarded as something natural or absolute, or even particularly moral, but as a way in which we, or some of us, contrive to obtain the best advantage for ourselves. And now at last, to Socrates himself. You're not incidentally meant to be able to read the stuff on the left. I'll give you a flavour of his methods by summarising Plato's dialogue, Euthyphro. Socrates and Euthyphro meet by chance outside a magistrate's office, that particular one, and Euthyphro explains that he's about to prosecute his own father for manslaughter. One of the father's workers had got drunk and murdered a slave, and the father had had him tied up and thrown into a ditch. The murderer had then died of exposure while the father was away getting legal advice on what to do. Euthyphro is now prosecuting his father because that is, he says, the pious thing to do. And Euthyphro is one of Athens' acknowledged experts on piety. This prompts Socrates to ask Euthyphro what exactly he thinks piety is. Euthyphro gives an example, what I'm doing now. Socrates explains he doesn't want an example of piety, but a definition which includes all possible examples. Euthyphro responds with, piety is what is agreeable to the gods. When he's reminded that a few moments before, he, that's Euthyphro, had said that the gods disagree with each other on all sorts of things, including what's right and wrong, Euthyphro amends his definition to, piety is what all the gods love. And now Socrates asks that question which has become known as the Euthyphro dilemma. Do the gods love what is pious because it is pious, or is it pious because the gods love it? Mm-hmm. Euthyphro eventually begs to reply that the gods love it because it is pious. So, says Socrates, pious can't mean loved by the gods, because that would be circular. Loved by the gods must be an attribute of pious, not its essence. Euthyphro is totally confused, but Socrates helps him out by suggesting another approach. Perhaps piety is a subset of the morally right. Euthyphro agrees and specifies that it is that part of morality which deals with tending to the gods. Socrates gets Euthyphro to admit that tending to people, as one tends to dogs or horses, is designed to improve them, whereas the gods are beyond the need for improvement. So Euthyphro switches the definition slightly. It's the sort of service that slaves give their masters. When Socrates asks what good this is supposed to do, Euthyphro changes tack again and suggests that the relation between gods and men is a sort of commerce. The trouble is that whereas the gods give us things we need, if we're lucky, the things we give the gods are not the things they need, just things that are gratifying to them. So piety is doing what is gratifying to the gods. But we've already shot that idea down. At which point Euthyphro says, another time then, Socrates. At the moment I have an urgent engagement somewhere and it's time for me to be off. Now, notice first of all, this whole thing we just heard is a discussion, not the expounding of a view. Socrates views philosophy as a shared activity in which people ask questions, challenge each other's assumptions. The trouble with books, he's made to say in Plato's Phaedrus, is that if you ask them a question, they always say the same thing. He never wrote a book or gave lectures, and he would disapprove strongly of this kind of talk. At least until the question session afterwards, when you can pull everything I've said to pieces. Secondly, the discussion is not an academic exercise. It arises out of an actual moral dilemma, whether it's pious for Euthyphro to prosecute his father for manslaughter.
And most Socratic dialogues begin with some practical problem, often about how to teach young people to become good citizens. The arguments, however theoretical they may be, are engaged in to solve some practical and important moral problem. And the other participants are very rarely philosophers. Thirdly, Socrates appears not to have any definite views of his own, at least in this dialogue, but is asking a so-called expert for his expert opinion. He does this, as always, with an ironic show of humility, as if longing to learn from someone cleverer than him. The expert opinion turns out not to bear scrutiny, and the important man Euthyphro is made to look rather confused. That brings in the fourth point, but far from settling the question that Socrates asked, the discussion ends in aporia. That's the term used by commentators for the state of uncertainty with which most Socratic dialogues of this period end. Some commentators call these dialogues the aporetic dialogues. Now, in the apology, that's the defense speech that Plato puts into his mouth, Socrates explains these last two features, the questioning of experts and the confusion that results, as a deliberate policy. One of his friends had asked the Delphic oracle if there was anyone wiser than Socrates. No, said the oracle. Socrates was amazed at this, as he regarded himself as extremely ignorant and stupid. So he embarked on a mission to disprove the oracle by interviewing men with a high reputation for, or claim to, wisdom, whether in politics or the arts or the professions, and by showing that they were wiser than he. But on every occasion, the men showed by their answers that they were not at all wise. This went on for decades, and by the time of his trial at the age of 70, Socrates must have alienated just about everyone in Athens. He showed them up as pretending to wisdom they did not have, and he did this in public, usually, to the great amusement of passers-by. Socrates' rationale for the oracle was that he was the only person who was wise enough to know that he wasn't wise. Over the years, his mission changed from an attempt to disprove the oracle to a determination, in obedience to Apollo's implied command, to persuade people to make your first and chief concern not for your bodies nor for your possessions, but for the highest welfare of your minds. He saw his role vis-à-vis the people of Athens as similar to a gadfly stimulating a large, lazy horse. That's the simile he gives in the apology. Elsewhere, in another dialogue, he is described by Meno as like a stingray who numbs people so that, like Euthyphro, they are reduced to a feeling of utter helplessness. And he tells the jury that he will continue his stimulating or numbing activity even if they acquit him, which they didn't. This may sound like a moral crusade, and in a sense it is, but Socrates is not a preacher appealing to people's emotions. He's not one of the philosophy teachers that are advertised on Facebook, if you put down philosophy as an interest, like personal trainers who would like me to make me look deep into my soul, find my identity, put some meaning into my life. Socrates is an intellectual through and through. Now, let's look at the most common feature of Socrates' elenchus. That's the Greek word used today for his method of questioning. That's his demand for definitions. Some modern commentators, including Wittgenstein, think that Socrates is wrong to attach such importance to definitions. We can live our lives perfectly happily and, in the words of Peter Geech, know heaps of things without being able to define the terms in which we express our knowledge. In fact, it's precisely because people do know what words like courage and justice and piety mean that they are able to have an intelligent debate about whether a given definition is invalidated by some counterexample. So what exactly is Socrates after? When Euthyphro gives his first proper definition, that piety is what the gods love, Socrates reminds Euthyphro of the conversation they'd had a few moments before. there, Socrates had expressed skepticism about the myths involving the gods, especially those in which they fight wars against each other. But Euthyphro, as a theology expert, had assured him that they are true. When Euthyphro now claims that piety is what the gods love, Socrates is able to turn that response back on Euthyphro. The gods are not agreed on what they love. Euthyphro now has to amend that definition. Now notice that Socrates is not here refuting the original definition with a fact that he himself claims to be true, but with a belief that Euthyphro holds, and which Socrates almost certainly does not. It's not that the definition is shown to be false, but that Euthyphro's position is shown to be incoherent. Another example of a definition is that of courage given in the Laches, where some generals are discussing what sort of experts to send their sons to so that they can learn to be courageous. As usual, a practical context. Now, typically, Socrates points out that they must first be sure that they know what courage is. The first definition given by Laches is that courage consists in standing one's ground in battle and not running away. Socrates reminds him that some fighters, like the Scythians, and in one instance the Spartans, fight very bravely and effectively while making a clever tactical retreat. Laches agrees, and has to amend his definition, not because it's incoherent, but because it fails to include examples which he himself knows are courageous. A third example comes at the beginning of the Republic, the pre-Platonic bit. Cephalus, an old man, says, or at least is taken by Socrates as implying, that being just, that's the Greek word dikaios, which covers most of morality, really, being just consists in telling the truth and giving back what one has borrowed. Socrates imagines borrowing a sword from a friend who subsequently goes mad. Surely, he says, it would not be right to give it back, even if he asked for it. Cephalus agrees. Here, too, Socrates is pointing out an example of something that his interlocutor believes, which shows the definition to be wrong, too extensive rather than too narrow, in this case. I think, though not everyone agrees with this, that in these and other discussions, Socrates is not trying to disprove the interlocutor's definition by showing that it is inconsistent with facts. That, after all, would require that these facts were shown to be more probable than the definition. It's rather that he is showing that the definition is not consistent with other beliefs of the interlocutor, and that the interlocutor's belief system is therefore incoherent. It's significant that the last 4/5 of the Republic, where the Socratic dialogue gives way to Platonic exposition, attempts to provide exactly that kind of justice, a definition of justice, that is, where it fits into a whole system of ethical values based on something he calls the form of the good. If we accept that explanation of Socrates' demand for definitions to examine the coherence of a person's belief, the further question arises, what does it matter if the person's belief system is incoherent? It seems that many thoroughly decent people lead thoroughly decent lives without even knowing what a definition is, let alone having a coherent philosophy of virtue. Could Socrates really have thought that you need to know the place of, say, self-control in a system of ethics in order to be self-controlled? Do you have to be an intellectual to be moral? Well, he does say in another early dialogue, the Protagoras, no wise man believes that anyone does wrong willingly. He does not claim that you need to be an intellectual to be good, but he suggests that you do need to be intellectually mistaken to be bad. Now, when I first came across that view of Socrates, I thought it was just plain silly. But let's take an imaginary example of Socrates are probably considered bad. I'm walking along a deserted lane. I see a woman wearing a Rolex watch that I fancy, so I knock her down and take the watch. There are three possible explanations here. Firstly, I have no moral scruples at all. I just want the watch, and if asked by the police why I took it, I say, I wanted it, so I took it. The second possibility is that I have a grudge against society, especially people who, unlike me and through no merit of their own, can afford to buy Rolex watches. So I believe the woman deserves to be knocked down and robbed, just to redress the balance in my favour. That's what I tell the police too. And the third possibility is I simply feel like taking the watch and have no serious moral scruples. But I do feel the need to justify my actions morally, perhaps even to myself. So when asked by the police why I took the watch, I make that stuff up about feeling hard done by it. How might Socrates, in his role of prison visitor, assuming I've been caught, how would he deal with me? Well, in the first case, the cynical case, he might say, contrary to my plea in the apology, you are putting possessions above the welfare of your psyche. That's the word which is translated indifferently in translations of soul and mind. If only you knew that your psyche is your real self, and that your body and material possessions are irrelevant, you would not damage your psyche by doing a morally bad thing. In the second case, where I have a reason for doing it, Socrates would ask me what I meant by words like society, merit, and deserve, until I realised that my logic was seriously flawed, and that what I thought was a justified act was in fact wrong. From then on, I'd stop stealing watches from women in country lanes. In the third case, he might well adopt the same interrogation procedure as in case two, but it would make no difference to my later behaviour, as my action wasn't actually based on the reasons that I used to justify it. So he'd be better off arguing as if it were case one. Case three is awkward, I might. I'll leave that. Now, someone who does wrong simply to get some advantage for himself is mistaken in thinking that the body and possessions are more important than the psyche, which is damaged by the perpetration of bad acts. On the other hand, someone who does wrong for a reason that he thinks justifies the act is mistaken in thinking that the reasoning is logical. Either way, no one does wrong willingly. QED. That's why, in the dialogues, the target of Socrates' attacks is not so much people's bad behaviour as the views they hold about ethical principles. That is, the reason which might underlie both what they themselves do and the way they react to what others do. He's keen to show that those who think they are wise in these matters, and who, just like today, pontificate about other people's bad behaviour as well as their own upright lives, do not have a coherent understanding of the ethical concepts which they bandy around, and of the way they fit into a consistent philosophical system. The focus on definitions of the virtues is a way of showing up that lack of coherence. Now, how wide did Socrates cast his net? If you've read Plato's dialogues, you'll have noticed that Socrates' interlocutors are exclusively aristocratic men. That, however, may be more to do with Plato's literary intentions than with the true facts about Socrates. It does seem fairly certain that the real Socrates, as opposed to the Platonic Socrates I've stuck to up until now, was a well-known figure among the people of Athens in general, for two related reasons. First, he's a central character in Aristophanes' comedy, The Clouds, which was produced when Socrates was about 46. As comedies were formed as part of a competition in front of a mass audience far too large to have contained more than a minority of aristocrats, it's fair to assume that Socrates was a well-known character around Athens. In fact, the targets of Aristophanes' scorn are ideas that Socrates probably didn't himself espouse, obsession with scientific research, for instance, and the teaching of rhetoric, but which must, like Socrates, have been familiar to the audience for the comedy to make any sense. Secondly, the jury at Socrates' trial, 24 years later, consisted of 501 men, and it's thought that, on other grounds, that juries in that period were predominantly from the bottom half of the wealth range, and probably the top half of the age range, i.e. not aristocrats, but predominantly ordinary people. In the apology, the defence speech which Plato attributes to, Socrates claims to be facing a general prejudice against him, which he attributes partly to the comedy, taking it as read that the jury will know the play and probably saw it in their youth. He complains that people associate him, as the play did, with the common run of sophists who charge fees, teach rhetoric, and have theories about the physical world. He appeals to the majority of jury to be witnesses themselves. I ask those of you who have ever heard me talking, and most of you are in that category, to talk to each other and to explain. Tell each other if any of you has ever heard me discuss such matters, i.e. scientific theories, either briefly or at length. Here he, or at least Plato, is assuming that the majority of this huge jury have not only heard rumours about Socrates, either in the comedy or elsewhere, but have on some occasion actually heard him talking. Of course, the real Socrates may not have said anything of the sort, but Plato, in writing the speech, must have thought that the words would at least be plausible to his readers. So I think we can take it that Socrates, as a person and a talker, is regarded as something familiar to ordinary people. To bring this topic round to the question of the day, what is the point of the philosophical activity in which Socrates engaged? As I was writing this, people were rioting in various cities in England, and it occurred to me to wonder how Socrates would have reacted. One thing he would certainly not have done is express a view either condemning or excusing the rioters. In that he would be unique. But I can imagine him traipsing round the streets of Tottenham or Salford, barefoot and shabbily dressed, as usual, listening to people, both rich and poor, giving their opinions about the rioters to television journalists. One, who may have taken part, would say, they just want respect. Another, who disapproved, would ask, why do people think it's sensible to attack the very community that they're part of? Those are both actual quotations I heard from people in the street on television. Socrates would not contradict either of them, but would ask one, when you say respect, what exactly do you mean by that? And to the other, he'd say, please define community and what it is to be a part of one. Assuming he didn't get punched on the nose, the discussion would then continue along the lines of the Euthyphro, with the interlocutor ending up confused, but acknowledging that things which what she had thought was obviously true was not consistent with other things which she had to admit she believed, and so her position was not coherent. Anyone who could be persuaded by Socrates to play his game would, whether they knew it or not, be doing philosophy. They would be using the tools of analytical philosophy, for instance, defining terms, being logically consistent, even distinguishing between essence and attribute, to examine the beliefs they held. Not any old beliefs, but beliefs which underlie, or are thought to justify, both their own behaviour and their reaction to the behaviour of others. To conclude, Socrates claims in the Apology that the best thing anyone can do is every day to have discussions about virtue and the other topics you hear me discussing when I'm examining both myself and others. For a human being, the unexamined life is not worth living. So when he asks for a definition of justice or piety, he is not kicking off an academic seminar, but asking an ordinary person to examine, in an entirely rational, even intellectual way, an idea that he himself has brought up, and which is the basis both of his behaviour and of his judgment of the behaviour of others. Examining one's life, in Socrates' interpretation, means first abandoning any claims one thought one had to wisdom, and second, subjecting one's beliefs to rational examination to see if they cohere together, and so might conceivably be true. This is dangerous stuff, and not just for Socrates if he chooses the wrong person in Tottenham to interrogate. If we follow Socrates in examining our own assumptions, we may find that they are incoherent or erroneous. And if we base our way of life and our views on other people's way of life on assumptions that we come to realise don't stand up to analysis. Not only is any smug feeling of wisdom we may have banished, but we've got serious work to do. Much easier to behave like the lazy horse to which Socrates compared the people of Athens, and to live what he calls the unexamined life. Socrates would agree with my last sentence coming up, which is actually the words of Camus, which I'll translate for you. Beginning to think is beginning to be undermined. Right, that's it.
Thank you very much. Bob, we've got time for questions and discussion in here, 10 minutes or so, so I actually need to think about it for a while.
Turn this off.
Oh, yes.
Partly because I can't actually see the audience.
Oh,
it's
actually to do that. Is there anybody
who's saying?
Well, just a little thing.
Can you
hear?
Yes, I can hear. Fine. Yes.
As you said, there was a quip near the beginning, Anthony's doing this for decades and decades. By the time he was 70, he probably antagonized most people in Athens. So just a... Have you found in your experience, or would you like to say, whether you think that actually the majority of people, especially when shown to be incoherent, are most likely to, you know, do all sorts of things other than, I think of things again, whether from running away or becoming violent or whatever.
Yes, I mean, it's a fairly idealised picture that Socrates makes people realise, see that their own views don't make sense. So they go away and think about them, that's all they do.
Yeah.
The actual, when people question me about my beliefs, I come to think that you're here, and I tend to change the subject like you've got to agree with something. Can you hear? I'm not speaking to a microphone. Can everyone hear me at the back?
Yeah.
I'll speak up. So I think it would be an idealist. And if you read Plato's dialogues, I probably have them. They are at all. Plato's dialogues make Socrates out to be kind to people, but in an ironic sort of way, so you feel that you're being laughed at all the time. And quite a lot of Socrates' interlocutors do actually comment on this, if he's an extremely annoying person. I think that's enough. He probably had alienated more people than he'd changed.
I wondered if you actually believe that the unexamined life was not worth living, because it strikes me that one of the great advantages of an unexamined life is that you wouldn't know it wasn't worth living.
I suppose the ideal, I think that lots of thoroughly decent people leading thoroughly decent lives without knowing what a definition was. And I suppose that would be the ideal, to be just, for some reason, to be a naturally good person who got on with other people, but without ever thinking about it. So that, I think that's the thing. If you had no intellectual curiosity, but had been brought up well, you wouldn't need it.
Pipes.
Don't like that word, but yes. Yes, in a way.
I just wondered, I absolutely loved your talk. I thought it was completely fantastic.
But
no, it was said completely sincerely. I was just wondering how Socrates' rejection of Acrasia, of the idea that we do wrong willingly, what do you think of that? And do you accept that? Or do you think, because we do tend to think that sometimes we do something wrong knowing that it's wrong.
Yeah, listen, I've often wondered
I often think that much more about other people than I do about myself. It immediately shows it's
you mustn't
a catch there. Yes. There are times when I should get up in the morning and can't be bothered, and I know that I should, but I don't think I'm not aware of ever doing anything at the time when I'm doing it, thinking it's wrong. I'm normally justifying what I do by saying it's right, and then afterwards I think, what I did then was wrong, and I was doing it for a reason which was just simply a desperate attempt to justify something deep down I knew was wrong. I think on the surface, if I do something really wrong and bad rather than just lazy, I'm at the same time thinking up some reason to justify it.
And you think you're thinking up the reason at the same time, prior to or at the same time as doing it, rather than afterwards? Which
might
be the important thing.
Yes. Sometimes I'm justified afterwards. Like, if I did something wrong out of sheer ignorance, I want to justify it to other people, I might think up a reason. But I think if I'm sort of vaguely aware that what I'm doing is wrong, I think probably I'd be thinking that reason desperately at the time. But whether everybody is like that, I don't know.
Can I intervene a second? But would people not maybe be mostly way up the chances of being found out or not?
Well, let me give you a little an example. When people are talking about speed limits, not allowed to go more than 50 on that stretch of the A449, many people talk without any self-constituting, as if the only thing that matters is whether the camera is working or whether they get caught. But a lot of people don't even think it might be a good idea to go below 50 because someone had thought out that that road it meets the 50-mile limit. So I think to some people, laws, and to other people, even moral rules, are not actually set in stone. They're just the conventions that we have to obey. So it'd be possible to think, can I get away with it? Not out of cynicism, but because you don't really think that there should be that rule anyway. Like paying taxes, some people think that tax is just an imposition. Why the hell should I pay them? I've got to. But if I get away without paying them, I won't. But whether it's possible to think simultaneously, I believe paying taxes is morally right, but I'm going to see if I can get away without it. I doubt. But I don't know that.
Right, well, we've got Peter's starting to warm up now, so Peter, pick one now.
I was wondering whether maybe Socrates is a bit of a second division philosopher, really. because he's reactive rather than proactive. That when we had this great national crisis of sort of riots on the streets, apparently all he's going to do is go out and sort of eavesdrop and see if he can hear anyone say anything stupid and then show them they're completely stupid. But what you actually want is some really wise person who's going to actually be a bit more forthright and constructive and say, look, what's going on here is, and sort of lead us. And so he doesn't qualify as a great philosopher because of that.
No, I think in that sense he's that sort of, well, the Socrates I was concentrating on is the sort of philosopher who's going to shoot other people down rather than produce any great ideas. But I think certainly in the current climate of post-riot deceptions, someone like Socrates would be quite useful.
I'm not denying second division philosophers are quite useful.
I should say that he was regarded as an absolutely top division philosopher by later philosophers who simply took what they could from Socrates and then tried to treat Socrates as their founder.
But don't you think a great philosopher ought to be a bit more creative than he was?
Well, probably.
But
Terry
existed. Charles, you have any questions?
In terms of coherence, we're talking about people show people what their concepts were not coherent. The world, the human world, is far too complex for any head to hold a completely coherent set of concepts, where everyone joins up with it, where the edge of one concept in every case joins up with the edge of another concept. the whole thing is far too complex for any one head to encompass it, and B, as we know now, concepts are essentially, necessarily, inevitably fuzzy, uncertain, and therefore it would require umpteen lifetimes of study of philosophy and every other subject that you can think of before you could even approach coherence.
I think that Socrates would agree with you absolutely. And he's several dialogues, not just the Apology, saying that he himself feels completely out of his depth dealing with these things for that sort of reason. But what he's after is people who think they've got it sorted, who think that their view of the world is coherent.
Socrates would do that.
Well, you don't, because you've just told us that it can't be coherent.
He's an exception.
I think there was a question here. Yes, I was interested in that discussion of evil a moment ago, and I wondered whether we were predominantly focusing on sins of commission rather than what most of us do, which is sins of omission. You have a view?
Yes, I can certainly think it's much easier to not to do something you know you should do than to do something deliberately you know you should do. Just by while realizing you should really have done it.
And it tends to be. I wonder whether they attain to the same systems of values.
Whether the ancient Greeks did.
No, sins of commission, yeah. you can generally see the effects, whereas sins of omission are, to some extent, calling on quite sophisticated value systems, where you're going through sort of almost counterfactual situations.
Yeah, often when I'm reading these disputes where people can either do something or don't do something, and it seems that they don't do something, then as they're kind of opting out, they're not morally responsible for what they don't do. I've never understood that. It seems to me that sins of omission are just as clearly wrong as sins of commission. But sins of omission are much easier to do and justify yourself in the sense, well, I didn't do anything, so it's not my fault.
Gentlemen,
in the red, did you? Oh, I think we've got it.
Okay, Frank,
just like a sort of parallel, I see the relationship of Socrates, Plato, and Bentham to Mills. Following on from what Peter Gibson was saying about Socrates being a second degree philosopher, it seems to me that one was preparatory to the other. You wouldn't have had Plato as he is without Socrates having prepared the way, having produced the aporia, which it then certainly required somebody else to solve. Now, whether Plato solved that satisfactorily or not, and told us with his theory of the good what the positives were, is disputable. Similarly, Bentham gave us a type of utilitarianism where you couldn't easily distinguish between the satisfaction of a pig and the satisfaction of a genius, if you like. Mills then had to go on and produce distinctions which, in my mind, weren't entirely logical, but were necessary to fill out the gap which was still left at the end of Bentham. Do you see the parallel?
I couldn't possibly comment on Bentham and Mill, but for what it's worth, the Stoics, for example, another great school of ancient Greece, they regarded Socrates as their great mentor, just as Plato regarded Socrates as a great mentor. And the academic skeptics of Plato's Academy, about 3 or 4 generations after he died, also regarded, more the Socrates I've been talking about, that is of Socrates, they regarded him as their great mentor. So, and the Cynics also regarded Socrates as, in a sense, as their founder. So, there could be a parallel, but as if Bentham had, say, spawned several schools of philosophy, all improving on him. But I don't really know anything about that yet.
You've got time to put in here. Yes, I would expect. Yes, I wonder what you
say about the following scenario. If you have an aircraft on the tarmac and you have a hijacker holding people hostage, and the authorities ask Socrates to come in and help out with negotiations. So he then has a chat with the hijacker and points out his illogical, incoherent thinking, and asks him to give himself up. But I suppose the hijacker may say, well, I understand what you're saying and I agree with you. If I was, say, Dr. Spock of Star Trek, I could agree with you that my thinking is illogical and incoherent and I give myself up. But being human, I am not Dr. Spock, and therefore I can hold contradictory desires. So how would Socrates answer?
Well, the Socrates that I've been talking about probably couldn't, because to my mind, the weakness of his position is that the reasons people use to justify what they're doing, or what you can argue about, aren't necessarily, even very often, the actual cause of their doing it. It seems to me people can make things up to justify it. That third case scenario I mentioned, where I just rob the woman because I feel like it, but I'm justified. The reason I robbed the woman is some psychological thing in me. I didn't actually rob the woman, by the way. he could argue with the hijacker for as long as he liked. It isn't actually getting to the main springs of the hijacker's action, which is something that could be an important decision. So I agree, it's not these places in that point.
Well, there are still people who want to ask questions, but we've run out of time, so keep those for the panel discussion at the end. So just thank Bob.